Hi, this is Allison Sheridan of the NoSillaCast podcast, hosted at podfeet.com, a technology geek podcast with an ever-so-slight Macintosh bias. Today is Sunday, March 14th, 2010, and this is show number 250. Woohoo! That's a quarter of a century of shows or something like that. What's that called? Should be a name for that. Seems like a milestone. Not like 200 when George from Tulsa made me the most amazing poster for my office with all these amazing, wonderful photos. You know, I put that giant poster up in my office. It's like 6 feet across. It's positively wonderful. But still, 250 is cool too, right? Well, anyway, as you know, I've been off relaxing for the weekend with Steve for our 27th wedding anniversary, along with our goofy friends, Dean and Suzanne. Yes, 3 days of frivolity, wine tasting, and more frivolity. Have you ever had the perfect weekend? Well, we actually did. We picked them up at the airport on Friday morning and drove to Santa Barbara for lunch. They've been cooped up inside for months since they live in Chicago, so just a single ray of sunshine for them is a cause for celebration. They definitely really enjoyed that. Well, they were constantly enchanted by the fact that we were outside in March and just actually enjoying the sun. We take it all for granted since we live here, so it's kind of good to be reminded of how lucky we are. From there, we drove up to a little town called Ballard that's deep in the wine country of Los Olivos. It's nothing the size of Sonoma County, say in the Bay Area, but there's like 20 times as many wineries as you could visit in a weekend, so it's perfect. We got to the Ballard Inn a little too early, so they suggested we go over to the Rideau Winery. We decided to walk, and it was a lot farther than we thought. We did get to meet a lovely rabid dog, luckily he was behind the fence, and then we saw the miniature horse farm. I thought they were cute, but Dean couldn't get over how fat they were. We finally got to the winery, and it was wonderful. Great wine, and Dean liked the fact that there was a huge party of very young women there. They were so young, we actually asked if they had to be carded, and the guy goes, oh yeah. Well, the next day, we figured we probably shouldn't go wine tasting before breakfast. I think we showed tremendous restraint there. Instead, we went for a long drive up into the local mountains. Without a specific plan, we still found this great drive. It was this giant loop that went up like, I don't know, a couple thousand feet. Spectacular views. Now, Southern California is a beautiful place, but the one thing it is not known for is the color green. We favor colors in the tan family because, see, we get so little rain and a lot of sun, everything just dries up right away. So even if the grass grows for a little while in spring, it all turns brown. But this year, we had a ton of rain. Okay, so not a ton by Bart standards, more of a sprinkle or two in his world, but for us, it was a ton. Because of all that rain, the hills were a vibrant green that was just stunning. I have never seen the local hills so gorgeous. It was freezing up on top. Okay, not freezing by the people in Minnesota's way of looking at it, but hey, it was 41 degrees and then really, really strong winds on top of that. So we mostly sat in the car and looked at the view and waved at it. Then we stopped at a small market in Los Olivos and had a fabulous tri-tip sandwich. Man, those were just really good. Now, that fortified us enough to embark on some serious wine tasting. So first, we visited an old favorite, a place called Foxen. And I kept telling Dean and Suzanne that Foxen was this great little ratty winery. You know, it wasn't one of these big fancy pants kind of places, this ratty little place. And we go up to Foxen, and it's this fancy pants place. Well, it turns out in the decades since we've been there, they actually built a new wine tasting room, and it's all fancy pants. But luckily, they got so many complaints that people were worried they were getting rid of the ratty one, is that you actually drink three glasses at one, and then you go down to the ratty place, and you get the second three down there. So people love that little shack, and so did we. So that was really fun. And again, we ran into a birthday party of young women. Dean, again, is in heaven. Well, anyway, from there, we went on to a place called River Bench, and what we liked best about River Bench was this lovely outdoor area with cast iron tables in the grass, this great sunshine and a light breeze coming in. We must have taken 2 hours to sip our six tastings of their wine. So finally, we dragged ourselves away and went on to Cottonwood, and that was the best experience. The person who served us was really down to earth. She wasn't one of those snooty, "Ew, this one has good nose," or "Do you smell the broccoli in this one?" None of that nonsense. Nope, Christine said things like, "I think this one is fun. Think backyard barbecue." We liked her a lot. She did sort of speed us through the tastings. We got there late, and I think she was trying to get us to end on time. So she was kind of like, "Taste this, taste this, taste this." It was kind of fast. But then she took us on a tour of their caves they use for storing the casks. It was really cool. Well, actually, it was really kind of warm and humid inside, surprisingly enough. Well, she even stuck a giant syringe type device, like a I don't know, looked like a turkey baster sort of thing, and she sucked up wine out of that and put it right into our glasses, right out of the cask. It was really, really good. That was fun. One of the women there said she'd had that done before, and every other time the wine had actually been nasty, but we got lucky and it was really good. The two things that were interesting to me was that they spray the syringe with sulfur. And the winemaker actually told me that it was an antioxidant, and it keeps the wine alive. He said without the sulfur, it would actually die. I don't quite understand that. But anyway, then they pump argon gas into the cask before they push the cork back in, and that pushes all of the air out, so there's none in there with the wine. It was very interesting scientifically. I liked it. Well, I could tell you more, but you're probably bored already. Okay, one more story. When we went to Sedona with Dean and Suzanne the last time, I forgot to bring shorts, and it was really warm out. So we went to some really cheap store to find something I could wear, and Dean picked out the most hideous pair of turquoise plaid Bermuda shorts for me. I loved them. And of course, I wore them constantly to embarrass everyone, and it's become a tradition for me to wear them every time we get together. They're really a sight to behold, seriously. Well, on this trip, though, Suzanne showed me what a truly great friend she is. She steps off the plane from Chicago wearing matching pink plaid Bermuda shorts. Words cannot describe how I felt when I saw her in those beautiful shorts. The fact that she would fly in a plane with strangers watching her wear these most hideous shorts. So, of course, there is a photo of the two of us in our finery, so you too can enjoy how marvelous the shorts really were. Anyway, the good news is that I put out the call before I left for people to help out with the show, and in true No Silla Castaway style, they came through. I hope you enjoy the reviews and commentary on this week's show. Let's start out with a review of Flex Clip from Connor P. that he recorded at Macworld Expo.
This is Connor P. from the International Mac Podcast, live on the show floor of Macworld 2010. I am here at Flex Clip Products, and they have just brought out one product, which is a fantastic new take on a belt clip for your iPhone or any smartphone. I am here with the inventor of the product, Harold. Basically what this is, I mean, it's audio, so I can't really, I just have to describe it, but it's a clip that you put on your phone, and the part that holds it is a small clip that expands and contracts, and it's got rubber on the inside, or silicone, and it'll hold your phone very snugly, and then it can actually flip up towards you. So without pulling the phone out of the belt clip, you can look down and see what's going on the screen, and it's very, very easy to pull it in and take it out of the holster. And while it's in there, it stays very, very snug in the case, and it's small, made of light plastic, so you wouldn't really notice it on your hip. It looks really like a fantastic product. How did you come up with this idea?
Well, the saying, the invention's birthed out of need, and I went through about four or five phone holsters a year. My son-in-law is in the phone business. He said, Dad, why don't you develop a better holster? And I looked at all the problems with the existing holsters. And again, when you realize that invention's birth in need, I designed it on each point that would make a better holster. It basically floats on your hip. It's easy to get in and out. You lift it up to see who's calling. And it's got longevity. The biggest problem with phone holsters is the fact that the rigid joint between the belt clip and the holster have premature failures. They break all the time. I believe that's why people carry them in their pockets. So we think this is, you know, the ultimate phone holster. And here at the show, we're really selling the units faster than we can put them out.
Yeah. Before this, I've never really been a holster kind of person, but I just feel more comfortable in my pocket. But this actually might change this just because it's so easy to pull it in and take it out. They've also got another product that they're coming out with called the Thigh Phone. It's slightly more of a niche product, but still is actually a very, very good idea. It's a suction cup that's mounted on a plastic base that has an elastic strap on it, and you actually snap the strap around the upper part of your leg, and you'd be like, Connor, why the heck would you want to do that? Well, I'll tell you why'd you want to do that. Think about not only when you've got the iPhone, but think about when the iPad comes out. You're sitting down on the couch, and you're typing on the iPad, and it's just sliding all over your lap. You put the iPhone on your leg, and then you suction cup the iPad to your leg, and it stays right there. It's a really stable base, and you can just type away on your iPad or your iPhone, and you've got a really stable base for doing that. So these two products look really very promising.
Yeah, I appreciate that. The iPhone, again, was developed, you know, for physically challenged people, commuters, school students, people that needed hand-free capability. But when the iPad come out, that wow, we already have a product that you can put the iPad on, and it's a big product, I realize, for that cup, but your leg stabilizes it, and you can rotate it either horizontally or vertically, and, you know, you can use the iPad or the iPhone either on the iPhone.
All right. When are they available? How much are these two products, and where can we get one?
Well, you can certainly get one on our online on our website. For the FlexClip, it's www.flex-clip.com. And for the iPhone, it's www.thiphone, that's thiphone.com. And you can buy either of them online.
And they're available now?
They're available now. That's right. We have a fair, a show special where they're $20 a piece. And normally they'd be like $24.95 a piece.
All right. Thank you very much.
Well, thanks, Connor. You have a great interview style. You did a really, really good job with that. I could really picture it from listening to the two of you talk. I'm intrigued by the FlexClip device, not for me, but for other male friends of mine. Turns out girls in general don't wear clothes that really work for a holster. And definitely I don't. I don't wear pants with belts or anything like that. But, you know, Steve and Niraj have both complained about their holsters they have for their new Blackberries. I'll have to show FlexClip to them. I also can't wait to see this thigh phone. Sounds kind of goofy, but sometimes the goofy things actually work great. Thanks again for a great review. Now here's a really short message from Rose.
Oh my goodness, girls and boys. Miro is fabulous. So you remember a couple of weeks ago, Al said we should use Miro to watch vids. Now I'd tried Miro a couple of years ago, and it really didn't blow my skirt up. If you'll excuse the image that has just planted in your poor little heads. But hey, you know me, I do what the princess tells me to. So I downloaded and installed Miro. And of course, the princess is right. Miro is a great way to watch videos on your Mac. But what is the reason for this soundbite, I hear you ask? Miro comes with a couple of pre-installed feeds, so I dutifully checked them out. My favourite, wildlife highlights. You know I love the wildlife. Mammals and birds and insects and primates. This feed comes from a mob called earthtouch.com, and if you like nature vids, you have to check it out. The production values are very high, and it's visually stunning, especially on Isabella. Now, I can't remember, Al, did I tell you I have a 27-inch iMac? Well, I do, and Miro vids on a full screen on a 27-inch iMac? Absolutely stunning. Love you long time.
I'm so glad you like Miro, Rose. I am loving it for video playback. The only thing I do wish they did was give you an indicator if you're partway through a video. On iTunes, you have the solid blue ball for unwatched. It's half filled if it's partly watched, and it's gone for completely watched. In general, I delete video podcasts if I'm done watching, but sometimes I save one to show to Steve. On Miro, everything shows as either watched or unwatched. It's a good trade-off, though, that minor inconvenience versus no spinning beach balls and stuttering. I think I'll keep Miro around at least until Apple gets that awful iTunes tightened up again.
Hi, Allison. This is Switcher Mark from Seattle. Thank you for last week's midweek surprise conversation with Amber Greener about her move to Ubuntu. If you don't mind, though, I'd like to offer a short rebuttal. I'll preface this with two comments. First, this is not personal. Amber seems like a perfectly delightful person, and I really enjoyed your conversation. Second, I know nothing about Linux or the Linux community. I wouldn't know a Linux build if it fell off the shelf and hit me on the head. But there was one particular part of your conversation that nearly made me fall out of my chair. For those who don't know what I'm talking about, here's a clip of that conversation.
I wanted to get into that a little bit, if you don't mind, is I think a lot of your joy about Ubuntu is the community itself.
It's very much the community. I mean, I like all the geeky, nerdy, whatever kind of stuff. No offense to anybody, but I mean,
embrace that here.
Yeah, I mean, I came out of the closet and embraced my inner geekiness. I mean, so it's not a big deal, but to me, it is the community part of it. And when you, and this is the thing, I guess, that kind of sold me on Ubuntu over my Mac. Probably the one point more than anything was when I opened my Mac, I don't have a whole community that I can turn to.
My first reaction when I heard this was, what? Of course, that's not very intellectually satisfying, so let me elaborate. I picked up the nickname Switcher Mark in June of 2007 when I bought an iMac and switched from Windows to Mac. Why I needed a nickname after I bought my first Mac addresses Amber's statement. As a new Mac user, I found myself posting dozens of beginner questions on all of the great Mac web forums. You know what's even better? I got answers. Usually quick, intelligent, helpful, and polite answers. No Apple snobs condescending and flaming the noob. I really don't like my nickname today because it doesn't seem right 3 years after my switch. But I can't change it. You know why? Because there are several people in the Mac community, many that I consider to be friends, that I communicate with on a regular basis that only know me by that name. I realize the existence of nicknames doesn't prove my point, but the active forums and the building of these relationships does. There really is an out-of-the-box Mac community that, as far as I can tell, is available to every Mac consumer, not just the Uber nerds and the power users. Of course, I can't ignore the network of Mac podcasters that cover the gamut of Apple and Mac news, tips, rumors, and frankly, the Apple community. Your show, and the fact I'm sending you this comment, is a perfect example of the Mac community that exists. While I suspect a good deal of today's Mac community is online, it certainly isn't a new phenomenon. Your audience is likely even more familiar than I am with the long history of Mac user groups, and from what I've learned, the survival of the Mac platform during the dark decade was due in no small part to the strength and resilience of the Mac community. Like so many others, I made my switch after using an iPod and wanting a computer that worked just as well. I can say that was a mission accomplished. But what I didn't expect to find was the thriving Mac community that loves to share the pleasure of using Apple products, commiserates when things aren't working as they should, and collaborates to find solutions to those problems. Amber briefly acknowledged Macworld as an example of community. But even I'll acknowledge that the vast majority of Mac users will never attend Macworld. But the mere existence of Macworld for the last 25 years speaks volumes about the rich Mac community. With all due respect to Amber and her joy of using Linux, I'm here to say there is a Mac community, and that community is one of the chief reasons I love this platform.
Mark, I couldn't agree with you more. I'm really glad to have your perspective on this, though, because you know, I'm not a switcher. I was never a Windows user, and I just always kind of assumed that there was this whole community of Windows people that all helped each other and were nice, kind people and not snotty and kind of helped each other find cool tools and, you know, help the noobs and help each other as they get higher up in the geekiness and all that. So it's interesting to me that that you found that the real community was over on the Mac side here, too. I wonder how Amber never got into the community. That's kind of interesting. Just didn't get lucky, I guess, like the rest of us, that's for sure. I for the people listening right now, I played the entire thing for the Nocilla Castaways, the nickname we have for the Uber fans here who like to come to the live show, because I think that really, really exemplifies this community feel. You know, I feel like I'm in a room full of friends, and now having met a lot of them at the Macworld Expo, it's really kind of neat to get to know people either way, you know, it just in text or actually in person. It's pretty fun. Oh, actually, this is pretty good. I'm reading the chat room right now, and Matt says that he's actually wearing his Nocilla Castaways T-shirt, also known as Balding Nerd. You should follow him on Facebook, on Twitter. He's hilarious. Anyway, I guess I better get back to work.
Dumb. Dumb.
Dumb.
Dumb questions.
Dumb questions. Dumb questions.
What do I? What is?
How come I always have to?
It's time for Dumb Question Corner.
Tony Beard wrote in with a great dumb question. It's just perfect because it's one of those don't moments. You'll love it. Here's what he wrote. Today I was very frustrated that the latest podcast was not downloading until I realized I deleted it in iTunes by mistake. Anyway, I subscribed again in iTunes and all is good. My dumb question is, though, when I resubscribe, I get all the old podcasts again and I have to manually delete them all. How can I subscribe in iTunes just from the latest podcast? Or how do I delete all the old podcasts without having to do it manually? Select one at a time and then hit delete. Love the show. Tony from Sydney, Australia. Well, it was fun to talk to Tony here. I haven't ever talked to Tony from Sydney, Australia before, so love those Australians. Got a bunch of those fun guys. Anyway, this is a great question. Even if you hadn't deleted the podcast by accident, sometimes they do just go bad all on their own. None of the podcasters I've ever talked to can figure out why this happens either. It'll work for everybody but one person. And the only solution for that person is to just delete it and start over as you've done. So this is a question that could actually apply to anyone because it can happen to you at any time. I've had it happen for other shows. It's happened to the big guys, the little guys, everybody in between. So we don't know why podcasts go bad, but they do sometimes. All right. Now, there's a certain amount of debate on how many episodes you're supposed to keep in your feed as the podcast creator. And as you've discovered, I've chosen to keep them all. So you have nearly 250 shows, well, actually now 250 shows, that all appear to come into iTunes. I've heard people worried about the RSS feed being too big. But guess how big the feed is for 250 shows? 512 entire kilobytes. Yeah, kilobytes. It's a half of a megabyte for the entire file. Because remember, the attachment of the audio or video recording doesn't actually get stuck to it, so it's really just a little text file. So I figure, what's the harm? Maybe you're going to want to get in there and listen to all 250 shows because you're a real, want to hurt yourself. But anyway, so I figure the only harm is that you have to know how to get rid of the other 249 shows if you want to start fresh. The good news is that they're not actually there in your iTunes. You're seeing placeholders to get them. The other good news is that you can simply select the top one you don't want, say last week's show, since you, of course, listen to my shows immediately when they come out, then scroll all of the way to the bottom to show number one, hold down the shift key, and select that first one. This should select all of the unwanted episodes, and then simply hit the delete key. So I got to tell you guys, I sent that explanation to Tony, and he wrote back with this don't comment. He said, I use shift select all the time in the Finder, but for some reason, it just didn't occur to me to ever do it in iTunes. This is what makes the Dumb Question Corner great. Well, while we were off on our wine tasting weekend, we got into one of our inevitable technology discussions. Dean is a big fan of the show, listens to everything I blabber about, and we get into these great tech conversations, and every time I see him, he ends up with 48 new things on his iPhone, so it's a lot of fun. But he was complaining about how incredibly difficult he's finding to find things in the new Excel 2007. Like so many of us, he's really good at Excel 2003, so having all of the menus moved around is really frustrating. I told him about the interactive Office 2003 to 2007 Command Reference Guide. I think I've talked about it on the show before. It's pretty cool. It's a Flash thing that you download, and it opens with either Excel, Word, or PowerPoint in Office 2003, or it looks like 2003. So you click on the menu where you know it is in 2003, and then 2003 fades away, and up comes 2007, and it shows you where that menu is in 2007. So Dean says, yeah, that's cool, but I don't get why companies like Microsoft don't just use screen steps to make tutorials for us so we can get up to speed faster. I love this, of course, because he looks at screen steps as the gold standard now, or what he expects for tutorials. He expects people to create their training in screen steps because that's what makes it easy for him to learn. If you're not using screen steps for your users, friends, and family, you really need to. You're making your own life harder than it actually needs to be, and you're not bringing the best training materials that you could to your users. For a mere $40, heck, $30 if you use the coupon code NOSILLA, that's my name spelled backwards in all capital letters, you can get the standard version of screen steps. Or heck, go crazy, go for the $80, $60 with my coupon, for the pro version. Go over to screensteps.com and download the free 30-day trial and see for yourself. Well, next up, we have a contribution from listener Ben on the Google Voice iPhone application called Voice Central, also known as Black Swan.
Hi, this is Benjamin Meyer, a Happy Nacellacast listener. Today, I'm going to review Voice Central, the new iPhone web app. So, what problem does this solve? Well, it solves the problem of accessing Google Voice from your iPhone. However, Google Voice recently released a new optimized touchscreen web app, but it doesn't look like iPhone native. This does. So what does it do, other than look like an iPhone native web app? Well, native web app. Well, what it does is it shows you your recent phone calls that you've made in and out of Google Voice, your text messages, again, sent through Google Voice, your contacts that are stored in your Google contact list, your voicemails, which you can read a transcription, or play them. It is really clean, and the interface is neat and snappy. However, it does have a few shortcomings. It's a little buggy. It's not that bad, but I have been able to get it to crash a couple times in normal use. Not like purposely trying to crash it, which would, why would you want to? Anyway, it is a little buggy, but it is free. If you decide to go free, there's another problem. There are a lot of ads. There's an ad at the top of every tab. At the top of the window, after you click on a tab, it's always there. But in the contact list, there are ads everywhere. Like, every two contacts, then there's an ad. You have two more contacts, and an ad. It really bothers me. It almost makes it worth getting the premium subscription for $7 a year. But I don't need to use the contact list that much, so I'm just going to stick with free. There are a couple features that do require a premium subscription. The only notable one is the Favorites tab under Contacts. It really isn't that big of a deal for me to have favorite contacts since I don't have that many contacts, only about 180. Thus, it is fairly easy to just go through and find the one I want. But under Contacts, you can also get a search feature, which works pretty well. It's a little slow, but is expected for a web app. I feel that it does go a little faster because it stores the data offline, however, versus other web apps. The search works well, but it's not great, and it doesn't search within the contact. I tried. When you go to install this web app, it's weird because you don't expect to have to install it. But what it does is that it downloads the application, I guess, into a HTML5 database of sorts. It's the best thing I could come up with on what it's doing. And it also stores the data there, too. Overall, I highly recommend Voice Central if you use Google Voice and own an iPhone or an iPod Touch. You can get it for free, like I said, like I am, and going to continue to be. Or you can get it as a paid subscription for $7 a year. You can get it from RiverTurn. It's also known as Black Swan, which you will need to know if you go to RiverTurns.com website. Click on the Black Swan, and you'll be taken to Voice Central. The link will also be in the show notes. Happy Nacellacasting, peoples!
Thanks, Ben. That was a tentatively positive review of Black Swan. A lot you didn't like about it, but enough good stuff that you'll actually keep it. I still don't get what Google Voice would do for me. Everyone I consider a friend has my cell phone number, and they all know how to call that. Our home phone's job is mostly for my mom, and as our base number for things like the doctor, pharmacist, newspaper delivery, that kind of thing. I don't miss calls very often, and I don't find it difficult to keep track of numbers or anything like that. I got an answering machine at home, and I got the stuff on my voicemail, and it seems to work just fine. I know others see this as the greatest thing in the world, but it just doesn't seem to solve a problem for me. Well, hey, I just realized there was all this hype about the iPad on Friday before I left, and I totally forgot to describe what my plan is. They sure have made it hard to decide which one to get, haven't they? Well, it's obvious to me that I have to have it on day one, right? I mean, seriously, how much would you expect me in my bleeding edge position if I didn't do that? So that means I have to have the Wi-Fi only model. But I really want the 3G model. So my solution, which I stole completely from Chuck Joyner, is that I'm going to buy the Wi-Fi only model on day one, and in 30 days or so, when Steve decides that we're worthy enough to have the 3G model, I'm going to buy that one too, and I'm going to sell my Wi-Fi model. I don't get all excited. I have a prearranged buyer. My friend, an avid listener of the show, Lynn, has agreed to buy it at a reasonable discount. I did have to put in a bunch of clauses, though, to our agreement, like I'm not allowed to drop, mangle, or drown the poor thing before I sell it to her. That drowning clause is going to be the hard one for me. So basically, I'm renting a Wi-Fi-only model until I can get my hands on the one I want. I did reserve the Wi-Fi-only model, and now I'm trying to figure out, how do I reserve a 3G model? See, the only option appears to be to buy one right now, but if I do that, they're going to probably deliver the stupid thing to me, and I do not want to sit home all day waiting for it to arrive. I want to race over to the store the first day and get it right then. So right now, I'm holding out until I figure out the optimal plan. Anyway, that's my plan, and I'm really excited about it. Okay, imagine this. You're a smoker. You're addicted to smoking. The nicotine keeps you coming back no matter what the impact is on your family and friends and your own life. You feel bad about it, but you've tried everything to quit. Well, it's just possible that technology may have an answer. I was in my friend Ryan's office this week when he pulled out a cigarette and started to smoke. Now, smoking is not allowed indoors in California anywhere, so you can imagine my surprise when he appeared to light up a cigarette. He then showed me his quote-unquote cigarette. It's called Green Smoke. This is such a cool product. Now, I got to put a disclaimer up front. I'm going to say it again at the end. I have no idea if this will actually help anyone quit smoking, but from a technology perspective, it's an awesome idea. The filter part of the Green Smoke cigarette is a cartridge that has an atomizer with a solution of nicotine, water, and flavor. You get to choose your cartridge based on the nicotine level and the flavor you desire. Flavors are things like chocolate, coffee, and menthol, which I thought was kind of weird, but whatever. But the nicotine level is pretty interesting. You can choose from 16 milligrams of nicotine, which is comparable to a non-filtered cigarette, all the way down to 4 milligrams, which is comparable to an ultralight. Or oddly enough, you can actually choose to you can actually choose 0 milligrams of nicotine, so the cartridge is only for flavor, but has no nicotine at all. The white cylinder part of the cigarette is actually a lithium-ion battery, which is used to heat up the cartridge. That makes the water nicotine solution into a steam, so as you draw on the cigarette, you actually get this warm feeling as it goes into your lungs. The battery section unscrews from the cartridge, and then can be screwed into several different kinds of chargers. It was so weird to see Ryan's computer with a cigarette sticking out of the side of it using his USB adapter. They also sell car and wall chargers, so you'll never have a dead cigarette. Like, that sounds kind of weird, but you know what I mean. So here you've got a cartridge that pretends to be a filter, a battery that pretends to be the tobacco part, you've got steam pretending to be the smoke. The one thing left out was not forgotten. When you pull on the cigarette, the end of it turns red just like an ember. They thought of everything on this. You can buy Green Smoke in about 28 different ways. They have starter kits, spouse kits if you want to quit with a partner. There's two of everything. You can buy the cartridges in packs. And of course, there's all the different charger options. So from a geek perspective, there's a lot of fun stuff to buy. Green Smoke is not the only company in this business, but they say they have a big advantage over their competitors. The other manufacturers have a fixed atomizer. But with the Green Smoke, you get a new atomizer with every nicotine cartridge, which reduces the chances of mold growing because of the moisture involved. Ick. Kind of like the idea of replacing that every time. I said to Ryan, I said, oh, that's just like when you have an HP printer, you get a new print head, right, every time so it doesn't get clogged. He says, yeah, just like that. Now, Ryan told me a few more interesting things about Green Smoke. He's very curious about how many draws on the Green Smoke atomizer is equivalent to a full cigarette. They advertise 20 draws, but he wants real recorded metrics. He wants to make sure he's not, say, fake smoking 50 cigarettes in a day. That would be bad. At first, he started making a mark with a Sharpie on the atomizer, but the marks rubbed off, so now he's using a knife to make little tiny marks in it. He says he'll supply me with a complete spreadsheet with pivot tables when he's done collecting his metrics. On a slightly more helpful note, he brought up a problem he had with the Green Smoke and how it was resolved. As I mentioned earlier, the white part of the cigarette is actually the lithium-ion battery. Ryan bought the Valentine's Day special, so he got two batteries in his kit. But the higher capacity battery stopped charging for him. Unfortunately, he was 31 days out of warranty, But just on a whim, he went to the GreenSmoke website, found the customer service email link, and sent an email including a description of the problem and his order number. In less than a half an hour, they wrote back asking, "Is it okay to send the replacement to your original shipping address?" He was completely blown away by the level of service from GreenSmoke. Like I said at the beginning, I can't say whether this will help someone quit smoking. I'm not a doctor. I don't know the implications of long-term nicotine usage, but this seems like technology really taking a stab at a tough, tough problem for people. If you're interested, check it out at greensmoke.com. Next up, we have our first review from Kirshen. I really like how she approaches her reviews, and I hope she does more because she's got a great voice and she really, I don't know, she just digs into the right parts of the problem, so I'm excited about having her here.
I'm reviewing Things Mac and Things iPhone by Cultured Code at www.culturedcode.com. These applications complement the Getting Things Done methodology developed by David Allen. I got interested in this methodology after reading about it in the Next Actions column at the About This Particular Macintosh website, www.atpm.com. I downloaded the audiobook from Audible last December and away I went. The philosophy behind Getting Things Done, in a nutshell, is to collect up all your open loops. These are tasks that you have to do, be they work or personal, so that you move them from your overfilled brain to an external tracking system. David talks about classifying these tasks based on contexts such as phone, office, computer, so that you can go through the tasks based on where you are at and even on how much energy you have. He also advocates using projects to collect tasks for which multiple steps have to be done to accomplish the job. There's much more in the method, and I encourage you to read or listen to the Getting Things Done book. Enter Things, my electronic task tracking system. Things makes it very easy to enter tasks into your inbox. Just press the plus button or command N or control space when Things is running and enter your task. When you're ready to go through the inbox, click on that and move the task accordingly to projects or whatever. You can set due dates, schedule recurring tasks such as reminders to pay bills each month. Things also supports categorizing tasks by projects as well as by areas of responsibility. You can also create team members and delegate tasks. There's even a someday folder where you can collect your long-term goals or further out tasks. Just get them out of the mind and into Things. Things lets you create and assign tags to your tasks. This lets you identify the context which you want to associate with your task. For example, you could assign phone to a task to indicate that you need to be by your phone to do that task. You can also assign more than one tag to a task so that you could have a task which had phone and home tags. Things then let you filter your tasks by tags so that you can quickly locate all the phone calls you need to make or errands you have to do. The best part about Things is that the Mac and iPhone apps seamlessly integrate with each other. All you have to make sure is that the iPhone and Mac are on the same Wi-Fi network and start both apps. The first time you sync, you have to pair the iPhone and the Mac, much like pairing a Bluetooth headset. And after that, it's all transparent. Things Mac has a menu item to sync on demand if you need that. There's a whole lot more which Things can do. Go check out Cultured Code's website. Now, you can actually do the Getting Things Done technique without using Things through a filing system and a set of tickler or memory jogger files. But wait, where's the fun or tech in that? I'm glad to say that keeping with the Getting Things Done mindset has been working beautifully. Firstly, it's remembering to keep track of all my projects and actions using Things for the iPhone and Mac. When I can't do that, I jot down the task or action in my LiveScribe notebook or a small 3x5 flip notebook which I keep in my purse. Later, when I have the iPod or Mac, I transfer the task items into the electronic tracking system. I've also emptied my email inboxes for home and work. And yes, there are no messages in any of my inboxes. I triage my inbox each time mail comes in and move task items to the add action, add read review, or add reference mail folders as mentioned by David Allen in his book. They're so named because they sort up to the top of your folder list. Then when it comes time to take action, I sweep through my add action folder and dispatch them. Any emails which I need a response to get filed in an add waiting for folder, which I review regularly to keep track of the response. It's been almost 2 months since I started on my voyage with Getting Things Done. It takes discipline to focus, organize references, gather tasks, and determine what next actions, but the result has been worth it. My brain feels a whole lot less stressed since I've been putting all my project tasks and actions to things, and even my home chores. I still need to sort out my filing system at home and at work, and to do that, I bought a Brother P-Touch PT2700 labeler for home, and it lets me print labels for Mac OS X, and also use the Brother labeler when from my lab when I'm at work. You can learn a lot more about getting things done at David Allen's website, www.gettingthingsdone.com. I highly recommend both the Things applications and use them both at home and at work. There's a hint on Cultured Code's website on how to use Dropbox to synchronize your Things database between several Macs. You just have to remember that only one copy can run at a time, since the database is single access only. Starting on the methodology has certainly helped me manage my tasks and reference material. I'm presently reading David Allen's Getting Things Done book to build up my skills and remind myself of what I've heard in the audiobook. Enjoy your Getting Things Done voyage.
I really love your reviews, Kirshen. You give us the why, the how, and you explain how you use it yourself. I actually read David Allen's book, and I got really energized by it. The point you make about your brain being less stressed because you have the situational awareness of your tasks at hand is one of the main points he makes. Because you know what you have to do and you've triaged the important things, you don't have the stress of feeling like things are out there that potentially are going to be a mess when you get to them. You know which one's going to be a mess. I have to say, I never actually employed any of what I learned from reading his book, but it all made sense. My friend David Roth said that he spent months after reading the book, Getting Things Done, trying to find the perfect application to create the nirvana of the book. Then he realized he was using it as an excuse to play with new software for the Mac and iPhone. Well, it sounds like Things really helped you get to what you learned and be able to use it. Yeah, maybe I'm going to have to give Things a try. Or I've been thinking about starting a podcast called Getting Nothing Done, where I interview people who had great ideas and plans but never got around to executing on any of them. Like I said, I was going to start that podcast, but I never got it started. Oh, well, do you really enjoy going to the mechanic? Do you find it a consistently pleasant experience where you meet with someone who's always competent, pleasant, and a joy to see again? Do you find their place of business clean and convenient to your home and work? Do you find that your car is tied up for the minimum amount of time with no unnecessary waiting? Guess what? I can answer yes to all of these questions. I'm talking about Honda Bob, of course. He comes to my house at my convenience. I relax in my home while he does all the dirty work. He's always friendly and fun, and above all, competent. I do not pay extra for this service. In fact, I consistently pay less than I would at a dealer. If you live in the LA or Orange County areas and you drive a Honda or an Acura, go ahead and give Honda Bob a call at 562-531-2321 or shoot him an email at hdabob@aol.com. HDA Bob's mobile service is not affiliated with Honda, Acura, or Honda Worldwide. It's that time of the week again. It's time for Chit Chat Across the Pond with Bart Bouchatz from BartB.ie. How are you today, Bart?
I am good, but I tell you something, that week just flew by.
It went from Friday to Sunday just like that, didn't it?
Just like that, yeah. It feels like just 2 days.
Well, I'm planning on not getting anything done next weekend because I'm going out of town for a little fun trip. And as always, don't forget, I've got Mrs. Kravitz living across the street who will keep an eye on my house. So anybody
like
thinks
a giant dog.
Yes. Our giant rabid poodle or whatever it is. Anyway, so we're recording actually a week early, and that's just been confusing our little brains like crazy here.
Yeah, because we're trying to remember what it is that we're going to have. Oh, I don't remember.
So, what's changed in Security Light since 2 days ago?
Well, one will assume that in the future, when people are listening to this, that Patch Tuesday that's due next Tuesday will then be last Tuesday will have gone.
Okay. So, reminding people?
Yeah, so if you're on Windows, you'll be told to update and say yes, please. And if you're on the Mac, expect to be asked to update your copy of Office. And if you have a copy of Office, of course, and also wake up those VMs or boot into that boot camp and let it do its thing.
Right. I bet that's easy to forget, so I'm glad you remind us of that every time.
Yeah, and as we're now in the future, or in the past, I don't have great futuristic reading powers, but were I to be a gambling person, I'd say that I'm sure something of Adobe's has blown up.
So you're predicting there's something bad will happen in Adobe land this week.
Yeah. If one, you know, it's like saying it's going to rain in Ireland, which I'm sure it will. and, you know, Flash or PDF or something will be broken.
All right. Well, that's a good safe bet. And so they should do something about that, run an update or something if it happens, right?
Yeah, keep an eye on the internet. It'll tell you.
Well, very nice. Well, we've actually got a couple of main topics. Why don't you start out the first one?
Well, the first thing is just, I mean, this is probably old news to everyone else, but I've only recently really got an Intel machine with enough grunt to be able to really make use of virtualization. So in work, I have now been playing an awful lot with VirtualBox from Sun Microsystems.
Now, that's the open source virtualization software equivalent to like VMware Fusion and Parallels, right?
Yeah, it does the same thing as those, except it's free and open source, and which is pretty good.
Now, when you installed that, did you have any trouble getting your virtual machine to talk to your network card?
No, none at all. In fact, I was really, really impressed at how the networking is done within VirtualBox. Because one of the things I need to do on Windows involves actual direct network access, so it can't be done through NAT or anything like that. It has to be on the network as if it was a physical machine. And so I just chose the option to actually share the hardware network card with the VM on the physical machine. And it just worked. Hmm. It was as if my VM was physically connected to the network.
I think I need to give it another try. When I did it, I had a lot of trouble. It gave me 4 network cards to choose from, and none of them had any indication of what they were relative to what I actually had in my machine. I mean, I have 2 network cards, right? I've got an airport card and an Ethernet card, and I don't know why there were 4, and I don't know which of the 4 were the 2 that I have, and I had a world hurt with it.
Okay, maybe it's something they've improved on then, since you had that problem.
It's been 6 or 8 months, I think.
I found it very straightforward, because I did Windows 7, so I had a Windows 7 DVD, stuck it into the Mac, went into VirtualBox, clicked the New button. And I said, would you like to make a hard drive? I said, yeah, we'll have a virtual hard drive. I'm going to call it this. I'm going to stick it in that folder, make it so big, give it a gig of RAM, and let it do its thing. And it just worked.
Hmm. Good.
I was in absolute shock when it booted up into Windows, and it was on the network.
So you've had your first experience touching Windows 7?
Yeah. I know, it's an improvement on Windows XP, but...
It's not. What is it they say, Windows 7, it's not as bad as you think?
Yeah, I know. I mean, there's many improvements and it's very shiny and stuff, but I wouldn't swap OS 10 for it on the million years. Oh,
that's for sure.
But what I have, actually, to be honest, what I mostly use is my Windows XP VM, because a lot of our software is older software. And there's a command line utility in Windows that's really good for keeping an eye on what's happening in DHCP in your network. It's called DHCP Lock, and it comes for free on the support tools as part of Windows XP.
Oh.
And it doesn't exist in Windows 7. They decided to get rid of it, and it was one of the best things about Windows. So I have my Windows XP VM, and it runs our call tracking system, which is icky and Windows-based. Yeah, it's pretty icky anyway, but the fact that it's Windows-based doesn't help. So I used to have an actual extra Windows machine in my office, and I used to use cords to connect to it over RDP.
Oh, jeez.
Yeah, so now I just have it sitting as a VM in my, on my Mac, and that's a hell of a lot nicer.
Were you able to get rid of the Windows PC?
Yeah, I turned it off, pulled the plug, I was delighted with myself.
So the IT guys that take care of that are probably happier too, one less machine to worry about.
Well, I am the IT guys.
So. Well, but you're not the Windows sysadmin.
No, but we're expected to look after our own machines.
Oh,
yeah, no one looks after it for us.
So the IT guy is happy you unplugged it then.
Yeah, I'm dead happy it's gone. Yeah, it was also very easy to install the tools. For a while I was using it without the tools, and it actually works absolutely fine without the tools.
Let's explain what the tools are.
Well, you don't install the tools. Your mouse is either in the VM or not in the VM. So you click on the VM and your mouse gets captured and it's sort of trapped within the VM. And then you have to hit a special key, which is the left command key, and that releases the mouse out of the VM back into back into Mac OS X. Which, right. I mean, it works, but it's a bit awkward. You have to remember how to release it and stuff. Whereas when you install the tools, it sort of does that automatically, because there's drivers added to Windows so that it can interact with the Mac. And as you just move the mouse over that window, the mouse events get passed into Windows without the mouse ever being caught. So you can literally move over and back. And the cursor changes from a Mac cursor to a Windows cursor. but you just seamlessly move it in and out. And it also synchronizes the clipboards between the two operating systems.
Right, right. In the old days, I know the running the virtualization tools was hugely important. Even more stuff like, the screen resolution wouldn't be right. The graphics card wouldn't know what it was doing. It was absolutely critical. Now it's just sort of, it puts a fine point on it, just polishes it up a little bit. But it used to be, you really couldn't use it until you ran the installer on the tools.
Well, I find that with, we use Xen virtualization in work, and I find that Xen really isn't happy without the tools. It's very, very primitive.
Now, hey, here's a Ubuntu / VM question. In in Ubuntu, in my virtual machine on using VMware Fusion, I still have the CD on the desktop of the virtual tools. Like, even if I reboot the machine, it still thinks it's that virtual fake CD of the tools is there. Can I make that go away somehow?
I don't know. I imagine it's being mounted by VMware, so within the settings for the virtual machine, you should be able to tell it not to do that, I would expect.
Yeah, I haven't actually looked around. I just realized it was just still sitting there going, why are you still there?
I did notice that in your screenshots, actually.
Yeah. So
With the Sun one now, the CD wasn't there by default. It was just an option in one of the menus.
Right, right. You did have to tell it to put that one, to put in this fake CD that doesn't really exist.
Yeah, although it didn't, I don't even know how it did it, because I just clicked the button, install tools, and it immediately popped up an installer. I don't remember seeing a fake CD show up or anything. It just went straight to an installer, let me click next a few times, and then it was happy.
Oh, there you go.
Rebooted itself. It was very nice. I have to say, with the direct network stuff and with the mouse just seamlessly going and the clipboard going over and back, I can now copy and paste with absolute triviality into the call tracking system from OS X. I'm just really impressed with how well it works. And, in some ways, VirtualBox is sort of considered the underdog as sort of a secondary to the paid-for options. But I tell you, very, very good free option.
Yeah, I definitely agree with you on that. Now, are you using Windows XP and Windows 7 captive in their own window, or are you letting them run free as where every application is looks like a Mac application? Except
no, I'm keeping them confined as a virtual window. Because I keep the whole Windows VM in a window.
Okay, good. I've done it the other way, and actually Windows 7 started to get real strange on me with VMware Fusion. They all have a different name for what it means to let the windows basically. How do you describe it?
Well, yeah,
an application
sort of
looks like a Mac application.
Yeah, it's a bizarre thing. What is it, coherence mode or something they call it in one of them?
One of them calls it coherence, right? So, like, if you use Command Tab to flip between your applications, you can see IE7 in from Windows and then Firefox from the Mac, just side by side as though they're the same thing, or from the same OS. But it got weird and slowed down and kind of buggy and strange on Windows 7 for me. I finally got rid of Windows 7 on my machine. I got tired of it. Bye bye.
To be honest, I'm not even sure if the Sun one has that coherence mode. It may do. I just haven't even looked for it.
Yeah,
I must have a look now. Yeah, it just strikes me as being confusing. I get the idea, but I prefer my VMs to be VMs and not to magically sort of beam into my Mac OS X.
Stay in your little box.
Yeah, no, it was just then during the day I was doing something at work, and I just realized that the Mac is just something very special, because I was sitting there with my Windows XP VM up, and it was live on the network, getting its address from the college's DHCP server as if it was a physical machine. I had my Mac running all my OS X stuff. And then I had an X11 running, and using X11 forwarding, you can actually have it that when you launch a GUI application on a remote Linux server, the GUI pops up on your Mac.
Okay.
So literally, you SSH into the server from the X11 command line, you type Firefox and hit return, and the Firefox window pops up on your Mac, but it's actually running on the server.
Oh, you're hurting my brain. What?
Yeah,
I don't even understand what X11 is doing in this story.
Well, X11 is Linux's window manager, which OS X can run natively. So you can run any Linux apps without even them having to be rewritten for OS X. And they'll use X11 to render their windows. But X11 forwarding is a feature of X11. The GUI doesn't have to be running on the same machine as the program. So it beams the GUI at the Mac. So I use it an awful lot in work for the network configuration utility for Red Hat Linux. It's actually quite good, and it's better than doing it from the command line. So I log into the server, I type the command to bring up the GUI, and instead of the GUI showing up on the server, it shows up on my Mac.
Okay.
And so I can command tab to it, and I can have everything I want. So I fix the stuff. It basically, it saves me having to get up off my backside, go up to the data center, enter in the alarm code, go in, unlock the cabinet, take out the KVM, find the right server, do the thing, close the KVM, lock the cabinet, lock the room, turn back on the alarm, and walk back to my desk. Instead, I just forward the GUI straight to my Mac.
Huh. Okay.
So at the same time, I had Mac Windows, I had Linux Windows that were actually programs running on a faraway server, and I had Windows, and it was all just running in my Mac and completely getting on fire and copy and paste between all three, and I was just like, this is the life.
Yeah, the only problem is we never get out of our chairs anymore, though, right?
Well, that might explain why there's a bit more around the middle these days.
I mean, every once in a while I realize I haven't stood up in 3 hours, you know? You got to watch that.
Aren't you supposed to do it every 45 minutes?
I think so.
Interesting theory.
All right, well, any more on that?
No, I think that's it. I was just, you know, it was my first time using the Sun VirtualBox stuff, and I was really very impressed.
I might need to give it another try, see if it's got the networking thing a little bit better nowadays. It was, like I said, 8 months ago or so. All right, our next topic actually dropped into our lap, which was pretty cool.
Yeah, we had to be all imaginative this week. Two topics, two whole shows within 1 week.
It's hard. It's rough. It's really hard. So I got an email from a guy named Ryan, and he's been one of the people that's been torturing me about doing Ubuntu things. And now that you've heard last week's show, not next week's show, you'll know that I was talking about this guy, Ryan. And he's one of the people who was really pushing me to try to play in the command line, that sort of thing. Well, he sent me an email that had, I don't know, thousands and thousands of words in it with no carriage returns at all. No line breaks, nothing. It was just this massive block of text. And I mean, like, pages of text. It was sort of like reading something from the Mac Mommy in the early days, except she uses line breaks. And I just wrote back to the guy and I said, you know what? There isn't any chance I'm going to read this unless you put some paragraph markers in for me, because this is crazy. So he writes back and he says, oh, don't worry. You know, you probably aren't missing anything if you don't read it. Well, then I was like, man, I got to read what this guy wrote if he's that funny. You know, he's like, yeah, I wrote 12 pages and I don't care if you read it. Well, it turns out this guy writes, types 120 words per minute. So I guess that was, you know, 6 or 7 minutes of writing for him. But he also explained that he was doing some weird tethering thing and copy and pasting through his iPhone to his Mac. And he was in an airport about to board a plane. And somehow between all his work he did there, he lost all the formatting because he did have formatting. But anyway, so now I've got to read it, right? So I went through and I made paragraph markers at arbitrary sentence endings just so I could, you know, grasp it with my head. And I found a section in there where he started talking about Apple and their work in open source. And he said, we really ought to talk about that. So I forwarded it to Bart because I figured he'd actually know about it and then could just explain it to me real slow. And you guys would get the benefit of that conversation.
Yeah. So, the main point that Ryan makes is that people don't give Apple credit for their open source work. Because you always hear the line, Apple are so closed, and I've said it as well, everyone says it. You know, Apple's so closed and so secretive, and they keep everything to themselves. And yet, at the same time, they're completely, totally, and utterly open by having a whole bunch of open source stuff. So they're kind of almost a schizophrenic company in some ways.
I don't think open source.
Well, actually, we should, because they have managed to do what Microsoft certainly have not. They've managed to both continue a proprietary software model and embrace open source and be an active contributor in the open source community. So give and take to open source, which has helped them bolster their closed source stuff, which is just head-wreckingly weird. Hmm. But Microsoft just sort of head in the sand, open source will go away, open source will go away, open source will go away. And if they keep saying it, they just hope it'll happen. Well, it isn't going to.
Hmm.
So I think Apple are probably a lot wiser. So OS X, believe it or not, is built on an entirely open source foundation.
Okay. Okay. So they took open source. That I think I knew.
Well, yeah, okay. But it's give and take. Because if you only take open source, that's not so good. Because Microsoft has done that. They took the BSD kernel, the BSD networking stack and stuck it into Windows 2000.
Okay.
They left the copyrights and stuff in place, which is fine because it was released under the BSD license. So Apple basically took the entirety of free BSD operating system and ported it over to the PowerPC and made a branch of it, which they called Darwin.
Okay.
And Darwin is still the core of OS X. It's basically everything up to the GUI is Darwin.
So you're saying Darwin was an invention of Apple?
Darwin is a porting of FreeBSD that Apple did.
Does this have anything to do with Darwin ports? Is that a coincidence name?
It's not a coincidence name. It's ports is a system on FreeBSD, and Darwin ports is that same system on the Mac. So they took ports from FreeBSD and made it work on Darwin. So Darwin ports.
Okay. Okay.
So
I'm catching up.
So they actually took the entirety of FreeBSD and re-implemented it as Darwin. And whenever Apple make changes to Darwin, they are made open source.
Oh, okay.
So Apple's engineering that they are putting into making Darwin better feeds back into the BSD community and can be used to make all the BSD distributions better as well.
And so do people actually do that? Do they take the Darwin improvements and pull them back in?
I have heard interviews on Floss Weekly with people from BSD projects who say that, yes, Apple contribute very well.
Huh.
And so it's all open source. You can actually go to the Apple Developer Connection and get the entire source code to Darwin.
Huh. Okay, cool.
That's a bit sort of hidden because most people don't look under the skin. So they have an entirely closed source skin on top of an entirely open source foundation.
Okay, and they play nice in the sandbox and they share their toys.
They play nice and they do share back with the Darwin with the BSD people, so that's good. And that's one of the ways in which Apple is very strongly open source. But it doesn't end there, not even nearly. Probably the biggest contribution and the most visible contribution they make to open source is WebKit, or the basis of Safari.
Right, right. Something else. Who else is on WebKit?
Well, WebKit comes from Linux. It was KHTML was its name when it was on Linux.
Okay.
And so Apple took KHTML and made Safari on top of it, and they contribute back the rendering engine as WebKit to open source. And Chrome is also a WebKit-based browser, and there are others.
So part of the success, or the goodness of Chrome can be attributable possibly to work that Apple actually did?
Absolutely.
And possibly vice versa over time, right? As Chrome advances, it could feed into what happens to Safari.
It does. It actually does, because the Google people are also very good with open source. So you have Google people and Apple people all taking from the one source and all writing back to the one source. So that's a wonderful way for everyone to help each other and to just drive all browsers forward. Now, the Google people have written their own JavaScript engine, and so have the Apple people. But both of them are open source, so you're learning off each other as you go.
The JavaScript engines are open source too?
Well, definitely the Google one is. I'm not entirely sure about Apple's one.
Okay.
But basically, they're all working on WebKit, and so they're all contributing back to an open source project. And then Linux is where all this came from in the first place, and they're massively benefiting from having Google and Apple really hammering away at the height of the browser wars on an open source rendering engine.
Wow. Cool.
Yeah.
That's kind of nice.
Yeah,
because
so
we all benefit from that.
We all benefit from that. And the two people who don't benefit from that are Firefox and Internet Explorer.
Because they're not WebKit, they're Gecko. Well,
Firefox is also open source. So Firefox has a lot of the open source benefits, but it's not benefiting off Apple's work. Well,
it's a Gecko engine, though. It's not WebKit.
It is, yeah. Exactly.
Right.
But on the other hand, the Gecko can improve from WebKit because they're both open source, and WebKit can learn from Gecko, so they can cross-pollinate, but it's not as direct a relationship.
You can't just pick up a library and plop it in.
It's never quite that simple. But Microsoft, on the other hand, are 100% isolated.
Oh.
None of their code goes back out, and they can't take in code because then they'll have to open source their product, and that's just not going to happen.
Which explains speed at which they develop new browsers then.
Yeah, and why they're so wonderfully bug-free and stuff.
Right.
And so ahead of the curve. All those new features coming from there first.
Hey, they got tab browsing now, don't they?
Oh, that's so a decade after everyone else. Yeah, so that actually explains why IE tends to get left behind, because they're not taking part in this cross-pollination in the open source sphere.
So they have to do all the work themselves.
They have to do it all themselves, whereas Apple give and take to the community in terms of WebKit. So, you know, Apple benefit very big from that.
Okay.
Another very important open source thing that is completely in Apple's hands is the Common Unix Printing System, or CUPS.
Oh, I've heard of CUPS.
Yeah. So Apple actually bought Cups, and Apple now maintain, Apple are the owners of Cups, which is used in Linux and Unix and all over the place, pretty much everywhere but Windows, to do printing.
You can own and something that's open source? How do you own something that's open source?
Well, open source means that you are allow people who don't own it to use it too. It doesn't mean that everyone owns it.
Oh, okay.
So the Linux Foundation own Linux, but it's open source.
I didn't know anybody owned Linux. Okay.
So Apple own Cups, but Cups is open source, so Apple are the guardians of it. And it's very important to Apple because OS X prints with Cups. But so do all the Linuxes and Unixes out there, so it's good for everyone that Apple is developing this and pushing out new changes.
So does that mean if a HP comes out with a new printer and with a new driver, that somehow, because Apple owns Cups and develops on that, that Linux would be able to print to that printer?
No, you'd still need the driver to be compiled for Linux.
Okay.
But it would be a lot less work to translate a Mac OS X driver to a Linux driver, since they'd both be Cups, but you would need the source code.
Okay.
So it makes it easier for HP to do that translation, but it doesn't make it, you can't just take the Mac driver and run it on Linux.
I see. Now, I remember years ago, maybe I haven't been paying attention. Well, definitely I haven't been paying attention, but I remember years ago, if you had trouble with a printer, on occasion it would help to install Cups. Was there, so there must have been a point in time when OS X was not using Cups?
I guess there must have been. That's probably before my time in OS X.
Okay. Because I remember somebody saying, well, just install Cups, and suddenly I was able to print to a printer that I hadn't been able to get to before.
I guess they must have taken something of their own across from OS 9 or something.
Oh, you know what? It could have been OS 9. Yeah, I'm old. Might have been OS 7.
Early versions of OS 10, they may have brought their old system and recompiled it for OS 10 and then decided to go with Cups. I don't know. But they certainly use Cups now, and they own it.
I remember back in OS 7 when we got the Multi-Finder, you know? That was the good old days. Sadly, I do.
Yeah. And they also contribute in other ways. Another one that Ryan mentioned that's very important is this whole new idea of Grand Central Dispatch, which they implemented by making changes to the open source GCC compiler.
Okay, you've just used a bunch of words I don't know.
Okay, so when programmers write programs, they write them in human-readable languages like C or Objective-C for the case of Mac software. And then you use a program to turn that human-readable stuff into actual computer-readable executable code.
Okay.
And that act is called compilation, and that translation is done by a compiler.
I have never heard it described that way. Okay, I'm with you.
Yeah, that's all a compiler does. It just transcodes between human-readable and machine-readable.
And human-readable is a broad term.
It's not normal. It's not normal person-readable, but it's programmer-readable.
Okay.
So there's a system for the GNU C compiler, or GCC, is the compiler that was written to make Linux go. And it's a very good C compiler. And Apple use GCC within their developer tools. If you install Apple's development tools, you will get GCC.
Oh, I didn't know that.
And they wrote extensions to GCC to support this their idea of a Grand Central Dispatch to allow you to make much better use of multiple CPUs.
Ah, I was thinking Grand Central Dispatch sounded like something that was handing things off between things.
Yes.
So it's handing them off between CPUs?
Yes. It's a way for you as a programmer to break your program into little chunks and to let the operating system distribute those chunks across all the CPUs it has in such a way that you will find that when you do some serious number crunching in a program that's Grand Central Dispatch aware, all of your CPUs will go up to 100% and the job will get done way quicker.
Okay.
And so they did that. They made that work so by extending GCC to support extra commands to do the Grand Central Dispatch stuff, and they made that all open source. So other Linux and Unix operating systems, everything but Windows, basically, can now implement Grand Central Dispatch if they want.
Everything but Windows? Why can't Windows do it?
Well, they'd have to open source Windows then.
Oh, if they used...
Well, they wouldn't have to open source Windows because I think Apple... No, sorry, GCC is GNU. Yeah, Microsoft just would not touch open source.
Oh, okay. So it's not that they couldn't. It's that they choose not to.
Yeah, in the case of GCC, that's a much more restrictive license. I certainly don't think they'd want to touch that with a barge pole.
Hmm. Okay, a barge pole.
Yeah.
Is that a really long, that's longer than 10 feet?
Well, you can have 10-foot barge poles.
We usually say I wouldn't touch it with a 10-foot pole.
We say 10-foot barge poles.
But you don't measure things in feet.
We used to.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. It's only when with the EU in the 70s that Ireland became metric.
Oh, okay. I wish we'd do that. But anyway, that's off topic.
Yes. So that's definitely a good example that Ryan mentions. Another example that's a bit different is the mini DisplayPort adapter, or mini DisplayPort standard that Apple created and then made available for free at zero licensing fee.
Oh, really? Anybody can use that?
Anyone can now get a license for free to use DisplayPort, the mini DisplayPort that Apple invented. And it's a fully certified standard by Visa.
Visa, the people that make the credit cards?
No, VESA. The video something standard something.
Oh, okay. Like, I've never heard of them. So
the yokes for mounting your telly to the wall are also called a Visa mount because they're standardized by these same people.
The yokes for hanging a TV on the wall?
There's a certain type of bracket on the back of all your tellies that's always the same.
Huh.
And that's
really?
a Visa mount. Yeah. So you can hang. So if you have the mountings on your wall for one telly and you go out and buy another telly, you can whip down one and whip up the other.
I don't know what you're talking about. We have these really fancy giant metal brackets for the LCD TVs, and they're all completely different. And one, you know, you have to look at the bolt pattern on each one is got like 75 different TVs can attach to it. But standard, I wouldn't call it that.
They should be now.
Wow.
Everyone should now be using Visa mounts.
Huh. I'll have to look for that. So.
But anyway, sorry. Yeah. So the DisplayPort adapter is a bit of hardware that Apple have invented, and effectively they've open sourced the hardware because the spec is free. So you know what you have to physically do to meet the spec, and you don't have to pay a license to use it. So effectively they've given it away.
Now that one really doesn't sound like Apple. I mean,
but it is completely in their interest.
Because more monitors
that way,
would
more
have
monitors
it.
Are going to support this, more projectors are going to support this, more TVs are going to support this, way more things are going to support this. If they make it free, instead of doing the thing that some other companies do when they invent a standard and try to use it as a revenue stream.
Well, but then they can't lock the market down to the $900 Apple Cinema Display instead of the $200 HP or Dell.
Yeah, they don't sell cinema displays by locking you down. They sell cinema displays by making really, really good displays.
Yeah, I was able to find Dell displays that had the mini DisplayPort when I was looking for one for Kyle, so I can see that. What is it about Apple and monitor ports, though? Gosh, I don't think they've
now
ever had
they've
two models in a row that are the same.
They never seem to like other people's standards, but now that they've made their own, I'm hoping that it's finally up to their high, you know,
well,
levels.
Well, they had mini DVI. Wasn't that standard?
Yeah, but the problem with DVI is that it's not theirs. It's encumbered with fees and stuff.
Oh, because someone else owns it?
Someone else owns DVI,
and,
yeah.
And they licensed it. Not,
yeah, no,
so
I'm
not
sure the exact fees involved with DVI, but I'm pretty sure it's not free.
But they even had two different ones. I remember trying to help a guy who was doing a presentation. He called me in a panic, and he needed the mini DVI to DVI
big
connector,
DVI.
The little dongle. And I raced down with the one I had that worked on our iMac, and his iMac was a different one. I mean, it was like you looked at it, it looked exactly the same, but it was just off by a smidge enough that the adapter didn't work. I've never had two Apple monitors in a row that have the same connector on them.
Yeah, likewise. So I'm really, really hoping that now that they've made their own standards, that that's going to be it for at least a couple of years.
No, it's going to be micro display port in about 10 minutes. Just like mini USB and micro display. God. You know, I have a couple of the one at work and one at home, the old cinema displays that use the, what did they call it, where they combined USB and video and power on one cable.
HDMI?
No. It had HDMI in it, but it was, I can't remember the name of it. You had to buy this giant doctor bot to undo it. So basically, if you didn't have the right model of hardware to plug it into, you couldn't plug it into anything. And so I've got this $150, it was described as the size of a three-egg omelet power supply with wires coming out all over the place. You should see what I do to use my Apple Cinema Display on it's a 22-inch Apple Cinema Display that's 9 years old, plugged into a brand new HP with VGA.
Wow.
All the PC laptops are VGA.
Yeah, VGA is crap.
Yeah, but that's what they have on them.
Now, yeah, but you want to be using digital. You really don't want to be using analog.
But that's what, I mean, this is a top-of-the-line HP workstation, and it's got VGA on it. Now, what's odd
still,
is, yes.
Dell don't do that anymore.
Brand stinking new. And what you can do, oddly enough, is you can put it into a dock, and the dock actually talks through some port and gets DVI out of it. So the dock will actually have a DVI out on it. So it's talking to a second graphics card inside that you don't have access to normally unless you're in a dock.
No, you want digital, so you want at least DVI, but I quite like DisplayPort.
Yeah.
Anyway, so that's sort of open source, open hardware.
Yeah, that's amazing.
And the other thing we should point out is that OS X has bucket loads upon bucket loads upon bucket loads of open source utilities underneath the hood.
Oh.
From simple things like the zip libraries, which is, it has gzip under there and tar and all of these kind of things. But it also has the open source implementation of Windows file sharing, which is called Samba.
Oh, right. Oh, I take that for granted completely.
Yeah, but that's come over from Linux. Now, I don't think Apple contribute to Samba. I think they literally just take Samba and use it. Which does bring us to a slight downside to Apple's open sourceness, is that Apple are notoriously bad at actually updating the open source components of OS X.
Right. Which is one of the reasons you whine at them regularly on that.
It is one of the biggest reasons I whine at them, because if there's, like, there are lots of operating systems that use Samba. All the Linuxes, the Unixes, and OS X all use Samba. But whenever there's a flaw found in Samba and the Samba people push out a new version, Linux has it within, like, 24 hours.
Wow.
And, you know, the Unixes will be the same, and then OS X has it 3 months later.
Yeah.
So you're completely vulnerable for 3 months to a known attack. I think that's disgraceful.
Yeah, why do you think that is?
Because I don't think they think it's important. Apple has yet to be stung.
And that's what I was wondering. Is that why?
I think that's why they're so complacent. Because there's nothing. There's no other explanation other than complacency. I mean, they have a little bit of work. They probably need to recompile it so that it's a universal binary and so forth. But really, it should take them a few days, and maybe a bit of QA, maybe let them go out to a week, but certainly not months. It's ridiculous. I mean, and they don't have, like, a patch Tuesday, so it's not that they're holding it back for a schedule. They're just
not getting around to it.
Yeah, they're just not getting around to it.
Well, they got to apply all those resources to throwing things out of the Apple, iTunes App Store. They got people working that. Those more important issues, right?
I don't think they're the same people. I hope they're not the
same
people.
And I probably shouldn't spin you up on that topic, but
no. So, you know, that's certainly an issue. Then Java is another piece of open source that Apple has within it. And that's one that they sort of make their own version of so that Java looks like OS X. And that means they're even slower sometimes on Java flaws, which is really bad. Another very important open source component that's within all versions of OS X is ISIX Bind DNS system, which is sort of the de facto standard for DNS.
ISIX Bind who?
ISIC is a group.
Oh,
can't remember what they stand for.
Okay.
And Bind is the name of their DNS server / client. And Bind is what makes OS X do DNS.
Ah.
So it's sort of the de facto standard DNS is Bind.
So that's another case of where they use it, not necessarily contribute to it?
I don't believe they contribute to it. Where they may contribute is in MDNS, which is, what do they call it? One minute it's Bonjour, the next minute it's something else. Or is it Bonjour these days and it used to be au revoir or something? I don't remember.
Yeah, what did it used to be? Yeah, no, it is.
It was another French one.
Right.
Rendezvous.
Rendezvous, which was easier to say.
Yeah, so yeah, rendezvous, which means get together, and now they're saying Bonjour, which means hello, so I guess. Yeah, that's certainly one that they would contribute to. That's a standard, because there's even versions of that for Windows that Apple create.
Oh, okay. Really?
So they're trying to make that sort of a more accepted standard, but I don't think they're getting anywhere.
Right, that seems to have faded. That was real exciting for a little while.
It was, but it's still a big part of OS X.
Right.
Because Macs just magically see each other on the network, and it's not magic, it's MDNS.
And MDNS, again, is...
Is Bonjour.
Bonjour, okay. Well,
yeah, MDNS just doesn't sound cool enough.
Well, and I know that's one of the reasons you're able to see HP printers on the network, is they use Bonjour or MDNS.
or rendezvous, depending on what century you're in. So there are some people
going, "Hello, I'm here. Would you like to print here?"
Yeah. It works in two ways. It's first, every time something turns on, it announces itself to everyone on the network. And then anyone on the network can also send out a request to say, "Is there anyone out here with the ability to print?" And then everything that supports Bonjour that is a printer will respond and say, "Yeah, I'm here and I'm at this IP address. And I'm such and such."
I wonder if that's why now in Windows you can just say, you know, "Show me the printers that are available," and it'll go out and scan and find them.
So the Windows have their own Windows networking-based stuff that does something similar. I don't know if they also use Bonjour. It's possible that they've now started to use it as well. I don't know that for sure, though.
Oh, okay.
Because Windows printers can be joined to domains and stuff. Anyway.
Right, a lot more complexity. So Ryan made a really good point that we have never really talked through that. And I had no idea so much of it was open source. I would not have made that connection. So I think it's a cool point that he made there.
Yeah, once you pop open that terminal, pretty much every command you can possibly type is open source.
Wow. That's cool.
Yeah. So it was a very good point, very well made by Ryan. So thank you.
Yes, especially since we would have had nothing to say for next week, which is today.
Which is this week. Ow!
All right, well, I appreciate you accelerating the schedule and getting this done so I can be lazy next weekend, Bart.
Yeah, it's going to be so strange. You're going to be sitting at home on a Sunday evening with nothing to do and no Allison to talk to. I'm going to be so lonely.
I'm sorry. I'll be drinking wine and having fun, though.
Yeah, I'm sure I'll find something fun to do.
All right, Bart, so we'll talk to you in 2 weeks.
Yes, until whenever. Happy computing.
Well, it's that time again. Time to call it a show. Many thanks to all the contributors who gave so generously of their time so that I could go on a little holiday without the guilt that you'd get a good show. Heck, we're past an hour and 20 minutes. They overshot the mark. They did a great job. You know, the Nocilla Castaways are the best. If you'd like to join us for the live show sometime, it's really easy. Just point your browser to podfeet.com/live at 5 p.m. GMT-8. That's also known as 5 p.m. PST, or Pacific Standard Time, on Sundays. Once you're there, you'll see my smiling video come up on screen, and I'll be showing you the recording as I'm making it. Sometimes I even show you images from the show notes. There's a live chat where you can talk to all the other listeners, and I promise they're really a kind bunch of people in there. This week, DZ Pix and Neelix both got to come in for the first time, and I think they had a really good time. They seemed to. They got into the spirit of it pretty quickly. Speaking of the spirit, they caught me actually putting the entirely wrong recording in. Kirshen did the testimonial last week on Screen Steps, and this week she did the thing on Things. And I tried to put the one on Screen Steps in for a second time, and luckily the chat room's like, no, you already did that one. Stop being a fool. So they're absolutely critical to the creation of a good show now. Also, Steve's always in there moderating to make sure it's a family-friendly chat room. I have to warn you, though, it's addictive. You might want to come back again and again. In the meantime, keep up your great dumb questions and comments by emailing me at allison@podfeet.com. Thanks for listening, and stay subscribed.